Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So first I'm going to make some introductory remarks. Then I'm going to take a first look at what the material world is, what it means to talk about the material world. Then I'm going to go through a series of topics. The four causes, which you may or may not have heard of, in the snapshot version. There's two versions. So the first is the snapshot version. Then I'm going to look at hylomorphism. Then I'm going to look at the four causes, the movie version or the cinema version. Then I'm going to look at matter, form, and privation. Then I'm going to look at the distinction between the substantial and the accidental. Then I'm going to look at act and potency. And then finally, I'm going to come back and take a second look at the material realm, what we mean by the material realm. Okay? So, introductory remarks. First look at the material realm, first four causes snapshot version, hylomorphism, four causes movie version, matter, form, privation, substantial and accidental, act and potency, and then second look, and that'll be it. So my title, as I suppose you know, is Aquinas and the Basic Principles of the Material World. Much of what I say will naturally enough focus on explaining some of the most basic principles, or you might say explanatory factors, that Aquinas appeals to in his account of the material world. These include the four causes, hylomorphism, the distinction between act and potency. However, I will, as you've already figured out, I'm going to sandwich my discussion of topics like these in between two discussions of just the general idea of what Aquinas even means by the material world. Now, the question of what the material world is and the question of what are the principles that govern it and the principles by which we understand it, those two questions are not actually separable in the end. To say what you mean by the material world and to say how you go about understanding and what principles govern it, like, those just go hand in hand. But nonetheless, if you divide them up for the purposes of exposition, it helps. And hopefully the order that I've chosen will be helpful. That's not my only hope. My other hope is that I'll find the right balance between giving you a sort of potted beginner level introductory account on the one hand, and on the other hand, some sense of where the complications and difficulties lie, because I realize people's background varies a lot here. It's important to get a sort of nice prepackaged thing, but not too prepackaged. It's important to actually realize that almost everything I say has like many layers of complexity and controversy behind it. If I get this right, then most of what I say will be pretty mainstream and uncreative, and a few things perhaps a bit provocative. So, let me get rolling by just giving you a first look at the very idea of the material world. Aquinas sometimes distinguishes between three main branches of inquiry, or what he might call science. We wouldn't call it science, but three main branches of knowledge: metaphysics, natural science, and mathematics. So to understand this three-way distinction, it helps to understand two distinctions. First, the distinction between that can... So the first distinction is this. Some things can exist without matter, and other things cannot exist without matter. Second, there's a different distinction. It's the distinction between things whose definitions involve matter and things whose definitions don't involve matter. So if you put those together, you can make a 2x2 grid and you get four
squares.
One of the squares presumably is empty. That's to say, there's presumably nothing that whose definition includes matter but doesn't need to exist in matter. Like, that doesn't seem to get anywhere. Now, actually, it's already complicated. But for now, I'm just going to act as if it's not. So then the second option of the four is things that do not need to exist in matter and whose definitions do not involve matter. And these things are what Aquinas would say are studied by metaphysics. So you study topics like substance, which you can give a definition of substance that doesn't appeal to matter, and there are substances that don't exist in matter, like angels. So the third and fourth options are mathematics and natural science. This is a little closer to our subject matter. Both of them, according to Aquinas, study things that cannot exist apart from matter. But there is the following difference. The things that mathematics studies must exist in matter, but their definitions do not include matter. So think of curves or planes. They always exist in matter. It's always a curved thing or something with a planar surface. But the definitions of these realities don't include matter. And so the mathematician can understand them in a way that abstracts from their materiality. That's why when you're explaining triangles and somebody goes, well, what if you drew the triangle with a different color chalk? It just shows that they have not gotten what's going forward at all, right? Because you're supposed to be focusing on what's essential, and the material implementation of it is totally irrelevant to what you're trying to talk about. Although, in fact, it can't exist without it. The natural scientist, or you could say physicist if you wanted to speak Greek, but it might be a bad idea. The natural scientist studies things that not only must exist in matter, but also that have to be defined in terms of matter. So explosions or dogs. You can't even understand explosionhood or caninity, doghood, unless you bring matter into the very definition or concept. So if we call this natural philosophy, we're lumping together a lot of things, right? We're lumping together what we now would call physics, chemistry, biology, a bunch of stuff, which is fine. All right, so that's metaphysics. Probably not need to talk about it much anymore, but mathematics and natural science. Now, the Thomistic idea of the material world that I'm sketching out here, because that's what I'm talking about, what is the material world, is the world of things that both exist in matter and get defined in terms of matter. So the material world is the world studied by natural science or natural philosophy. But what does Aquinas mean by matter? In 21st century English, to speak of the material world is pretty much the same as to speak of the natural world, the physical world, and the corporeal world. It's to speak of the world of three-dimensional objects, which are continually changing according to what we are accustomed to calling the laws of nature. So when we use language in this way, matter is the stuff that material objects are made out of. Now, there's nothing wrong with talking like this. However, it might be that instead of speaking normal 21st century English, we could switch into another dialect, the dialect called Tomish. And when we're speaking Tomish, then the adjectives that I just used, natural, physical, corporeal, material, they don't all mean exactly the same as one another. Nor can we count on them to mean the same as what they would mean in 21st century normal English. So if we want to avoid pitfalls, we're going to have to tread carefully and speak carefully. Sometimes when Aquinas uses the word that we translate as matter, of course, he never uses the word matter, right? Because he doesn't write in English. No, I mean, it's important to remember that. I don't know how much he might have known a little bit of English, like past the parchment or whatever. I don't know. But not much, right? Why would he? He wouldn't have even have needed it. When Aquinas uses the word that we translate as matter, that's materia, he uses it to mean something that lines up pretty well with what normal 21st century English speakers mean by matter. But other times he uses it in a kind of different way. So again, we have to tread carefully, but that doesn't mean we can't say anything. We can get away with proceeding naively for a while. So that's because the world studied by Aquinas's natural science, the quote-unquote material world, contains those three-dimensional changing entities that I mentioned earlier, the quote-unquote material objects. So in this sense, and it's a very important sense, the realm explored by Aquinas's natural philosophy is the same realm as the realm investigated by today's physical sciences. And the explanatory principles that Aquinas uses do still have relevance today. Now, eventually, I will put a special twist on this, but that won't come until the end. So for now, we can get away with just kind of saying stuff. But I just want you to feel nervous. Okay. Now I want to move on to explore some of the key explanatory principles governing, or that we use to explain, interesting distinction, the material world. So I'm going to talk about the four causes now, and in particular, I'm going to talk about the snapshot version of the theory of the four causes. Aquinas gets this largely from Aristotle. The way he presents them is sometimes offensive to the delicate sensibilities of Aristotle scholars. I don't have time to get into all of that. Father Ambrose, just have your smelling salts ready. Think of a statue. Why is it the way that it is? How can we explain its being the way that it is? Here's an answer. It's made of bronze. That's why it is the way it is. Here's a different answer. It's shaped a certain way. So that's why it is the way it is. Here's a third answer. A sculptor made it. That's why it is the way it is. And a fourth answer is, it's meant to honor someone, a movie actor, let's say. So that's why it is the way it is. These answers are different from each other. They are different types of answers. And indeed, they are answers to different types of questions. Even if those different questions all got formulated by the same question, by the same set of words, why is it the way that it is? You can mean four different things by that. So the first of the four concerns what something is made out of. The bronze. The second concerns the shaping or arrangement of what it's made out of. The third concerns what brought it to pass that what it's made out of came to be shaped or arranged in the particular way in which it did in fact come to be shaped or arranged. And the fourth concerns the goal for which the arranger arranged what it's made of. Now, these four questions and answers are four explanations of the statue. In traditional Thomistic language, they are four different causes. The way we use the word cause today in 21st century English seems mostly tied to the third of these, the explanation of the statue in terms of what brought it about that the bronze was arranged in a certain way. However, the word cause does show up in other senses as well, even in ordinary speech. When talking about goals and purposes, the fourth on our list, we sometimes use the word cause, as when we say, the money is being donated to a good cause. And even if we don't use the exact word cause, either for arrangement or for what gets arranged, we do say that the statue is the way it is because it's bronze, or because of the arrangement of the bronze. So the word cause has crept its way in there as well. So now let me give you some official names for these four causes in reverse order. That for the sake of which the statue exists is its final cause. That which brought the statue into being is often called its efficient cause. It's called efficient from the Latin word facere, to do or to make, and not because it involves a process that gets excellent results from minimal input. It has nothing to do with efficiency. The shape of the statue is called its formal cause. You can think of the shape as being its form. And the stuff out of which the statue is made is called its material cause. The material cause is the stuff out of which the statue is made, like bronze. You'll notice that the word material just came up in a slightly different way. It's not the last time this is going to happen. But you see the problem, right? The material world is made partly out of matter. Well, why only partly? Well, the words are starting to cause problems. Let me walk you through another example of the four causes. Why is a turtle's shell so hard to break? First answer, through the material cause, because it's made of keratin. Second answer, through the formal cause, because it's rounded. Resists pressure and blows better that way. Third answer, through the efficient cause, because its parents passed on genes that led to a hard-to-break shell. Fourth answer, through the final cause, because having a hard-to-break shell gives you a better shot at living long and prospering. Now here's a third example, one that focuses not on the turtle's shell, but on the turtle itself, the turtle as a whole. Its material cause of the turtle is its body. Its efficient cause is its parents. Its final cause is to live a turtle's life. And if you've ever had the pleasure of watching turtles in a turtle pen outside your study, you will know that it's a really great thing for a turtle's life to be lived. It's surprisingly entertaining to watch. Did anyone notice that I skipped the final cause, the formal cause? Yeah, good. For Aquinas, as well as for Aristotle, the formal cause of the turtle is, get ready, its soul. Now, there are two reasons why this might lead you to raise an eyebrow. First, you might be surprised at the thought that turtles have souls. Second, you might be surprised at the idea that a soul is a form. It's really only the second one that I want to talk about. But I got to say something about the first one, too. So do turtles have souls? Well, in the Aristotelian sense, yes. Because in the Aristotelian sense, a soul, or what Aristotle would call a psuche, he doesn't use the word soul. When Aristotle wrote, the English language didn't even exist. A soul is an internal principle, that makes a living thing be alive. That's just what the word soul means for him. So if that sounds weird, it's because we use the word soul to mean rational soul. For Aristotelians, all living things have souls, even plants. What humans have a corner on, apparently, is not souls, but rational souls. So don't let this worry you. It's not as crazy as it sounds. It's not the view that turtles are capable of doing calculus, but they keep it quiet. You know, it's not that at all. There was an album by Stevie Wonder called A Journey Through the Secret Life of Plants. It's not that. Okay, now let me switch to the second point, namely the idea that the soul is a form. In explaining the concept of form, I started with the example of the shape of a statue. How then can a soul also be a form? Is a soul a shape? Is the soul of the turtle merely the fact that its bodily components are shaped in a certain turtleish way? Well, no. The soul is definitely more than a shape. So what this reveals is that the notion of form is being deployed in a very flexible and analogical way. The soul of a turtle plays a role in the turtle that is similar to, but not the same as, the role that the shape of a statue plays in the statue. The relationship between the soul and body of a turtle is similar to, but not the same as, the relationship between the shape of a statue and the bronze. This analogy is dangerous and has confused many people. But don't blame me. Aristotle himself started this. Now, one last little point. I have said that these four causes are explanations. And here I just want to make clear, I'm not using explanation only in an epistemic or cognitive sense, according to which we say things like, wow, thanks, that was a great explanation. Sometimes explanation just means something that helps us understand. I'm trying to use it also in an ontic or metaphysical sense in which what explains something is what's responsible for its being that way, or at least partially responsible. As when we say that the high wind explains the damaged roof. And this gives then a little clearer sense of why we might call it a cause. It's what's responsible. Okay, enough of that. Let's shift focus a bit and talk about hylomorphism. H-Y-L-O, not E. H-Y-L-O-M-O-R-P-H-I-S-M. Hylomorphism. Aquinas says that two of the four causes are internal to the thing that they are causes of. The internal ones are form and matter. The form of the statue is, so to speak, a part or constituent of the statue. And its matter is internal to it as well. Now, suppose you think for a very wide range of beings, it's true that they have both form and matter. Your view could be called matter-formism, but it sounds cooler to say it in Greek. So you would say hylomorphism. The word hule is Aristotle's word for matter, and morphe is the word he uses for form. A hylomorphist is someone who thinks that everything in the physical material world is composed of both form and matter. Now, what about things in the non-physical world? Do they have both form and matter? Thomists say no. There were some medieval philosophers, however, who believed in something that they called spiritual matter. It's easy to laugh at this, and Thomists rarely miss an opportunity to do so. However, it is not nearly as crazy as it sounds. A bunch of years ago, I read a doctoral dissertation by a Catholic University student named Michael Sullivan. And he talks about, it's quite good, and it's not a crazy idea. Okay, so that was hylomorphism for now. Now I want to switch and talk about the movie version of the theory of the four causes. When I say I was giving you before the snapshot version, I've been taking something that already exists, a turtle or a statue, and asking why it is the way it is without considering the change by which it came to be into existence. In the movie version, we're going to focus on the process of change. So think of a bronze lump sitting there on the table. Someone melts it down and shapes it into a statue. We started with some matter, something out of which we were going to make the statue. We also, in a sense, started with a form, in the sense that the sculptor started with an idea in his mind of what he wanted the statue to look like. The sculptor, the efficient cause, brings it about that the matter takes on the form he wanted it to take on. He forms it, and the matter gets formed. You might even say that the matter gets informed. And the whole process is governed by the sculptor's goal of making a statue for a certain purpose. We can look at the turtle generation process in a somewhat similar way. Its parents have some gametes, which they, through processes best discussed privately among turtles, bring together. This causes the gametes to be transformed. That word again. To be transformed into a new baby turtle. So the gametes are the material cause out of which or from which the turtle came to be. And the parents are the efficient causes. And the form is the factor internal to the baby turtle that's responsible for the matter being a turtle's body and not some other kind of physical thing. Now, what about the final cause? It seems unhelpful to suppose that the turtles, I mean the parents, had a plan to create baby turtles. I don't think they think about that stuff. Instead, it seems better simply to say that the whole process is goal-oriented, without any need to suppose that the efficient causes, the turtles, had any plan in mind. So when you think about it this way, talking about final causality means thinking of a causal process as being oriented towards coming out a certain way, as being oriented towards that for the sake of which the process happens. This is an Aristotle phrase, that for the sake of which. There's such a thing as the natural or correct way for a process to end up, and there's such a thing as the process going wrong. The process goes the way it goes so that it can have the correct outcome. If you can accept all of that, then you've got the idea of final causation. And there's no need to worry whether the turtles are like, there aren't enough turtles around here. So the question of whether final causation requires mind is a very important one. And it's one of the many very important questions I can't address here. Let me just say this, though. Aristotle seems to hold that final cause does not require mind, but I think Aquinas thinks that it does. Not a turtle mind, but a divine mind. I think this is one of the ways in which Aquinas and Aristotle don't see things the same way. But that's controversial. Okay, so now that we've seen the movie version of the theory of four causes, let me mention something else that goes with the movie version, the so-called three principles of change, matter, form, and privation. In order to get a statue, let's say a statue of a bull, you need three things. You need some bronze. You need a bull shape, in your mind anyway. And finally, you need for the bronze not to be bull-shaped. In other words, you need appropriate matter. You need appropriate form, and you need the matter to lack the form. If the bronze is already bull-shaped, you can't change it to make it be bull-shaped. It's too late for that. So change requires that something lack what it's going to be changed into. In the case at hand, it requires a privation of the form of bull. All right, moving on again. Up until now, I've been silently glossing over what's actually an extremely important distinction, the distinction between the substantial and the accidental. There's an awful lot to say about this. I'm only going to say some of it. To start, I must begin by explaining two Tomish words, substance and accident. In Tomish, a substance is an individual, independent, unified thing. Think of the famous horse, Secretariat. Secretariat is an individual, not a universal nature like hoarseness. Secretariat is independent in the following sense. Secretariat can exist without being part of some larger whole. In particular, secretariat is not a property or feature of some entity, the way secretariat's color or speed are properties or features of secretariat himself. Finally, secretariat is one unified entity, not a team of horses, not a horse-saddle combination, or a horse-rider combination, or any other such combination. It's just one unified thing. So because he is an individual, independent, unified being, secretariat is a substance. In Tomish. An accident, by contrast, is, okay, again, in Tomish. An accident is a property or feature that is added on to a substance and depends on it. Remember when I said just now that secretariat's color and speed are features of secretariat? They are accidents, accidents that belong to the substance, secretariat. Now then, if you have a substance and it changes accidents, let's say it changes from red to white or from sitting to standing, then you have an accidental change, a change in its accidents. The substance remains in being throughout the change, but the accidents do not. One accident goes out of existence and another comes into existence. That's an accidental change. However, if a substance undergoes a change so radical that it passes out of existence altogether, only to be replaced by something else, then that is a substantial change. Suppose you hit and kill a turtle with your car. The turtle dies. It ceases to be. It goes out of existence. What's left behind is not a special kind of turtle, a turtle with the accident of deadness, but instead, no turtle at all. What's left behind, probably, in fact, is not one thing at all, but a bunch of things, a bunch of chemicals. You've left behind millions of things. That is a substantial change. The second substantial change that I have mentioned in this talk. The first was the turtle coming into being when its parents made it. The turtle gametes passed out of existence and were replaced by an embryonic turtle. Interestingly, here too, it seems that there's not a one-to-one correlation between what we have before the change and what we have after the change. Right? Because you start with two gametes and then you end up with one embryonic or zygotic turtle. I wonder if this is like some kind of universal law. I don't know. Whenever there is a substantial change, the number of substances before the change is different from the number of substances after change. I don't know. It's kind of fun to think about. Okay, so there's a difference between two kinds of change. Accidental change and substantial change. Now I'd like to explain one difference that difference makes. A difference having to do with matter and form. In the case of an accidental change, we can say that the substance plays the role of matter, and the accidents play the role of form. When Socrates gets a sunburn, he acquires a redness form, and the matter that gets informed by this redness form is Socrates himself. Okay, so again, we're sort of expanding and analogically applying this kind of language. So this business of Socrates getting a sunburn, it's kind of like the bronze becoming a statue. The bronze is the matter, and it remains itself through the coming to be of the statue. What changes is the shape and accidental form. The old blob form goes out of existence, and the new sleek bowl form comes into existence. So what I am suggesting, by the way, then, that a statue, that's not a substantial change. Basically, you're just changing the shape of a lump. It's just a lump with a nice shape rather than a blobby shape. So in the case of accidental change, the role of matter is played by something that's not very mysterious. A lump of bronze. Or a horse. Or a philosopher. But how do things look in the case of substantial change? What is the matter then? This is a hard question. Let's go back to the case of the turtle, and let's consider the two substantial changes in its life, its conception and its ignominious demise under your car tire. If we think of matter as existing both before and after the change, then we can ask what it is that does the existing both before and after the conception of the turtle, and likewise, what does the existing both before and after the turtle's death? Now, here is a really, really tempting answer. A bunch of chemicals, or maybe a bunch of atoms. Before the turtle conception, you might say, those atoms did not make up a turtle. After the conception, they had come to be related to one another in such a way that they did make up a turtle. Likewise, before the turtle death, those atoms made up a turtle. After the death, they were related to each other differently in such a way that they no longer made up a turtle. I call this a tempting answer. It seems to make so much sense, and it's more or less what we all learned in middle school science. Well, it's not the Thomistic answer. There's a long, complicated story to tell here, and I'm a bit worried that this could send us, you could have a whole conference just about this, and everyone would fight all the way through. But I have to say something about this. From Aquinas' point of view, it's just not true that there are atoms that exist before the turtle's life begins, during its life, and after its life ends. If there were, if that was the right way to think about it, then the coming to be of the turtle would not be a substantial change. And neither would the passing away of the turtle. Both of those changes would be accidental changes. Or rather, many accidental changes. They would be rearrangements of substances, the substances being the atoms. For a while, they're arranged in a way that gives rise to what we call a turtle, but it's really just a bunch of atoms arranged in a certain way. So a turtle being conceived would be like the formation of a business or a team. No new substances come to be when a soccer team forms, but instead substances that already exist come to have new relations among themselves. Likewise, dying would be like the breaking up of a business or a team or a band. No substances pass out of existence, but instead the substances keep on existing, only now without the relations that they used to have. But Aquinas doesn't think that's right. Maybe Aquinas is wrong. That's a different question. Aquinas' rather radical alternative is this. In the case of a true substantial change, there is no actual anything that exists both before and after the change. The matter, quote-unquote, that persists through the change is not flesh or chemicals or atoms or quarks or anything like that. It's what Aquinas calls prime matter, which has no actuality in itself at all. Instead, it's only a pure potentiality for substantial change. If you find this puzzling, even bizarre, then maybe I'm doing a good job of explaining it. It is a rather surprising claim. It's hard to know what it really means. The easiest way to understand it is this. Prime matter is a kind of primordial goo. A goo that's so primordial that it has no qualities or features at all. Normal goo, let's say, is slimy and green, but not much more. This special goo has no color, no viscosity, nothing. There's no way that it actually is at all. I said that this was the easiest way to understand it, but easiest doesn't mean easy, and still less does it mean correct. I don't think it is a kind of colorless, viscosity-less goo. I think it's very hard to understand the thing that I just described, this goo theory. And anyway, I think it's got to be wrong, because if you call it goo, you've already attributed to it some kind of actuality. So it's not goo. But like, people interpret Aquinas, or anyway, Aristotle, as holding this. I think, and sometimes I wish that was the right interpretation of Aristotle, because then, or Aquinas, because then I'd kind of understand where I was, at least sort of. But Aquinas' view is just super weird. So I've been contrasting Aristotle's view of prime matter with the view that the matter that persists through substantial change is atoms or something like that. That's putting things in terms of the movie version of hylomorphism. Now I would like briefly to return to the snapshot version. On Aquinas' way of thinking, it's false to say that turtles are made up of, let's say, carbon atoms. What we should say instead, now again, looking at the snapshot version, what we should say instead is that turtles are made up of little turtle bits. Turtle bits that act rather like carbon atoms, at least some of the time. Thomists sometimes express this idea by saying that the carbon atoms are virtually present in the turtle. But I think that this is beyond misleading. A virtually present carbon atom is present in the same way that a counterfeit dollar is a dollar. Namely, it isn't. Well, not just the same way. The question of prime matter is a very, very difficult one. It's easy enough to learn how to talk the talk and to say the right things. Like, you can just say these things on a test or something. Prime matter is the substrate for substantial change. A. Prime matter is pure potentiality. A. But what does it mean? My own guess is that much of the difficulty comes from covertly thinking of prime matter as a kind of thing and then asking what kind of thing it is. Perhaps instead we should banish the idea that prime matter is a weird thing that gets combined with another weird thing, form, to make up a normal thing, a turtle. Perhaps we should take an altogether different approach. Perhaps when we say a turtle has prime matter, what we really mean is only that the turtle has the potentiality to undergo substantial change and thereby be replaced by some other things. On that analysis, it makes no sense to talk seriously of combining prime matter and form, and therefore it makes no sense to talk about what prime matter is. Instead of thinking about what prime matter is, we should ask maybe what is meant by saying that something, quote-unquote, has prime matter, and then explain that in terms of its capacities for a certain kind of change. So perhaps I can explain this move by bringing up a rather distant analogy. Although we say that every group of students has an average height, it's confused to ask what kind of entity is an average height. Instead, we should ask ourselves what we really mean by saying the group has an average height, with the answer being something like, well, it's the number you get when you divide the sum of the students' heights by the number of the students. The point of this analogy isn't, of course, that prime matter is like an average. The point is only that we have a phrase, prime matter or average height, that might seem to refer to a thing of some weird sort, but which instead should be understood in a completely different fashion. Instead of asking what things these phrases refer to, we should figure out the meaning of the whole sentences that these phrases are contained in. I said I didn't want to go too far down a sidetrack. Perhaps I've already gone too far. So let me try to draw your attention to something that is certainly on the main line, and to do so in a way that will lead us towards our final destination. We have seen that change requires matter. Think of bronze. Why is bronze so useful if you want to make a statue? What makes bronze useful is not so much what it actually is as what it can be, what it has the capacity or potentiality for being. What makes bronze the suitable matter for a statue is that it has the potentiality for taking on the correct form. It can be shaped and then it will hold the shape. So it's better than toothpaste or jello. What I'm trying to draw your attention to is this. However we answer the really tricky question of what matter is, matter's role is to be the source of potentiality. Starting with the easy case of matter in an accidental change, matter is that in virtue of which the accidental change is possible. The substance that undergoes the accidental change is matter for that change, insofar as it's capable of losing the old accidental form and receiving the new one. Moving on now to the hard case of matter in a substantial change, prime matter is, whatever prime matter is, we talk about prime matter because we are trying to recognize that there is a capacity for substantial change in the thing that has prime matter. So whether prime matter is goo or something else, having prime matter is or involves being capable of undergoing substantial change, having the potentiality to pass out of existence and be replaced by something else. And that leads me to talk for about 15 seconds about act and potency. So we're almost done. Whenever there's a change, there's a potency or a potentiality, and then that potentiality gets actualized. Matter is where the potentiality lives, so to speak, and when matter is where the potentiality lives, so to speak, and when matter's potentiality gets actualized, then you've got form. So that last remark might raise a further question, a question that will lead us back to the question we started with, namely, what is the material world really? So now we're going to make our second pass. And here I will be following out some ideas from my former student, David Corey. Let's talk about angels for just a second. Angels have potentialities that get actualized. They can, for example, receive revelations from God. They can start considering things they weren't considering before. In fact, that's what led certain philosophers, as I mentioned earlier, to posit the existence of spiritual matter. Right? It was that in virtue of which they had potentialities that could get actualized. Now, as I said, Thomists don't go for this. I don't want to get caught up in the controversies about spiritual matter, but let me say that the kind of potentiality that we find in the spiritual realm, like angels, is different from the kind of potentiality that we find in the material realm. And this can be used to clarify what we mean when we speak of the material realm. Matter, for Aquinas, is not a special kind of stuff, the stuff that material objects are made of. Instead, matter is a principle of potentiality, but not of just any kind of potentiality. Think of a fence being repainted so that it goes from green to white. In order for the fence to become white, it needs to stop being green. Whiteness and greenness are incompatible with one another. And so change, in this sort of case, means not just gain, but also loss. This is the way things are in the realm of matter. Forms compete to inform matter. It's kind of a zero-sum game. But not every change is like this. Suppose I teach you a new word, like Geschwindigkeitsgrenze. To learn this word is a perfectly ordinary word. It means speed limit. You don't have to forget some other word. A new form can be added to the stock of forms that you already have. Likewise, if you forget a word, if, say, you forget what Geschwindigkeitsgrenze means, then a new word doesn't have to come in to take its place. To gain a color, you have to lose a color. To lose a color, you have to gain a color. But knowledge isn't like that. This is the difference between the material and the spiritual. Matter, again, is where forms compete. In the spiritual realm, forms can exist side by side without crowding each other out. And so we can say that the material realm is the realm not just of change, but of that very particular kind of change in which non-compatible forms succeed one another. Okay, so I have tried to sketch out some key principles of Thomistic natural philosophy in like 45 minutes or something. If the beginners have learned something and if the experts are only slightly offended, I'm going to call it good. But whether I can call it good or not, I have to call it done. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.